ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Most people in Australia making policy about housing don't want house prices to fall.
Oh, very simply, they cut my limbs off.
On Life Matters with me, Tegan Taylor, we crack open money, relationships, and the stories shaping your life.
I'm nobody's darling, believe you me.
Big questions, real solutions. Life Matters is where your stories shape the national conversation. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As President Trump issues yet another round of punitive tariffs on allies and enemies alike, should Australia turn its back on the US and consider a plan B for our alliances, for our future security?
Now, maybe you've been asking yourself that very question of late, but one Washington heavy hitter visiting Australia has a message for you.
For folks who are having this reaction of, I really hate what Trump is doing, I'm done with you, I'm done with America, I'm going somewhere else. I mean, maybe take a look in the mirror.
That's Eli Ratner. He's our guest for this episode. I'm Kylie Morris.
And I'm Hamish McDonald. I reckon this episode is going to make you think. Let's go roaming. So, Kylie, I reckon there's a couple of things that have happened just in the last few days which really, for me, stand out as examples of both how, in many ways, the relationships, the alliances are full steam ahead and as they have been for some time, but equally, it's a very different world and maybe we'd be crazy not to question some of those fundamentals that we've relied on for so long. On the one hand, we've seen a British nuclear-powered attack submarine arriving at an Australian naval base in Perth. So this is part of the AUKUS program where we're going to see these nuclear-powered subs arriving, rotating through here. On the other side of the coin, Donald Trump issuing a fresh round of tariffs, this time 15% after the US Supreme Court struck down his previous tariff regime of 10%. We're in this kind of crazy world of both having, wanting, maintaining alliances whilst experiencing pretty shocking behaviour from those very allies.
Yes. The only thing that's predictable about this alliance at the moment, it seems to me, is how unpredictable it is. Also, a survey conducted for the Sydney Morning Herald by Resolve showing that President Trump is significantly more unpopular in Australia than President Xi is. According to that research, almost half the public consider the US an equally big or even a bigger threat than China.
And I suppose what we're going to explore this episode is not just the downside risk of Trump and the US alliance, right? Because we talk about it all the time. But there's a kind of drop-down menu of questions that flow on from that, which go to the point of, well, if you're not going to rely on the United States in the way that you do, who do you rely on? And that's the bit that I don't think we talk about nearly enough in the context of all of the problems, obvious as they are, with the US, particularly under Trump.
Well, you might be surprised to hear that there are, in fact, Americans here right now who want to super boost alliances and PACs, very much here to deliver a message. We're lucky to have spoken to Dr. Eli Ratner. He was the Assistant Secretary of Defence for Indo-Pacific Security Affairs during the Biden administration, and we spoke to him in our Sydney studio.
Eli Ratner, welcome to Global Roaming.
Yeah, well, great to be here. Thank you.
You've just made a speech at the Lowy Institute here in Australia, making the case for a new collective defence pact in the Indo-Pacific. What's your argument? Make the case.
Well, the argument here is starting with the challenge, which is what I see and I think many defense strategists in Washington see as a mounting military threat from the PRC combined with unrelenting ambition from Xi Jinping to try to revise the regional order in the Indo-Pacific and seeing his military as an instrument in doing that. Were he to do that, it would be incredibly disruptive to our economies, our militaries, and very, very costly in a way we all ought to be invested in preventing. And so the proposal that I've put forward has been about taking the existing U.S. alliances that we have around the region with Australia, with Japan, with the Philippines, and actually integrating them together so the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. I think that's what's going to be necessary to maintain peace and stability into the future.
Specific mechanics of it, though, what would you like to see?
Well, we could get into relatively technical military operational elements here, but in general, what we need, which we don't have to date, is more integrated planning. We don't have actual military plans together for how we would operate in a crisis. We don't have a joint headquarters with our military leadership making decisions. We don't have joint command and control systems where we're able to operate together. And we don't have a good understanding of what our relative roles and missions would be in the event of a crisis. So it's really about working together in a much more integrated, seamless way and preparing for that. And the point is not just so if there is a conflict, we could present much more collective military power, though that's part of it. The real point is for deterrence and preventing conflict in the first place. And I think that's what's going to be necessary given China's ambitions and growing power.
What's the response to that idea been to those proposals? Because, of course, Australians are very protective of our sovereignty.
Well, there's a lot of skepticism. If this was easy, it would have already happened. But I think to the question of political sensitivity and sovereignty issues, obviously that's something that needs to be taken seriously. But from my perspective, what we're talking about here is preparedness. Are we going to be prepared or not to operate together, to deter together if we need to? I don't think something like this is going to lock the Australian Prime Minister or the country into having to do something it doesn't see as its national interest. What it does is it prepares us to be able to do so if we choose to, and in the process, hopefully, will deter conflict. So I understand it's difficult. Of course, now a lot of questions about the commitment of the United States. Does Australia want to deepen its partnership with the United States in this moment? But the fact is, we already have an alliance together. The United States already has an alliance with Australia. What this is actually about more than commitments with the United States is commitments with each other, for Australia and Japan, for instance, to integrate with each other and not just have the existing prevailing system, which is something that's often referred to as a hub and spoke model with the United States in the middle and separate alliances. This brings those allies together such that Australia and Japan could operate more seamlessly with each other.
You're here obviously speaking to foreign policy experts and officials, defense experts, but there is a public that has very strong views about these matters. Is it a strange time to be talking about building stronger American relationships in the world, talking about multilateralism, when it seems from the outside that America wants to go in the opposite direction? Trump's walking all over existing alliances, degrading NATO.
That is true to a certain degree, but I will tell you, here in the Indo-Pacific, America's alliances have been moving forward and deepening over the last year in near continuity. I was recently out at a defense conference in Honolulu. You wouldn't have known anything had changed in international politics if you were out there listening to military leaders from the United States, but also from Australia, from Japan, from other partners, describing their ambitions, their trajectories, their plans for 2026. We're going to have our biggest exercises ever. We're going to have more partners there than ever. We're going to have more capabilities than ever. So the defense and security cooperation has been siloed off, I think.
What's the difference then for this region compared with Europe? Like, why does this U.S. administration take a kind of full steam ahead approach here, and yet in Europe it's so different?
Yeah, well, I'm not here as a spokesman for the Trump administration, so I don't know the answer to that for sure, but there clearly has been a difference. And the animus that has been directed at the Europeans and the consequences of that, we have not seen, thankfully, here in the Indo-Pacific. I think that's in part because the Asian allies have responded in a very positive way in areas that are important to the Trump administration, on defense spending, on things like critical minerals. And also the nature of the China challenge is growing and severe. And the imperatives of that are that the United States is, in fact, working with its allies. Whereas I think in Europe, the perception is Russia and the European continent is something for the Europeans to deal with on their own. You don't hear that about the Indo-Pacific American strategists saying, hey, it's up to Australia and Japan to keep China at bay. That's not America's approach.
You used an interesting word earlier. You said that you think that China is seeking to revise the way it operates in the Indo-Pacific. What is the revision? What is the nature of the revision? And what is it that you're fearful of?
Well, I think we actually have a relatively clear sense of what China's military ambitions and security ambitions are in the Indo-Pacific. They want to unify with Taiwan. They want to seize Taiwan through force if necessary. They want to control the South China Sea. They want to weaken U.S. alliances, and they want to dominate the East Asian littoral all the way up from the East China Sea down through the South China Sea. I think that would be part of a broader effort of Beijing to control the economics and the politics of the Indo-Pacific in ways that would have very negative effects on U.S. national interests from a security and prosperity perspective and potentially from a political perspective as well. I think it would be really corrosive to our societies and our way of life.
Can I ask what you mean by that? Because let's just take the South China Sea trade routes. Let's say there's a conflict and China ends up in control or dominates that space. Presumably, they want it to operate peacefully and effectively. How does that damage the United States longer term?
It would give them coercive leverage over America's ability to access the most important economic and political region of the world in the 21st century. And what we saw over the last year was Xi Jinping absolutely willing to use coercive leverage over the United States, for instance, in the area of China's dominance in rare earths, to get the Trump administration to change its foreign policy and its politics. And I think we will just see versions of that. I think we've seen a micro...
Weren't you doing similar things to them with microchips under the Biden administration?
We were, but for different reasons. And I think I would not draw moral parallelism between the Communist Party and the Trump administration, as frustrated as folks are with the United States of America right now. I read in the paper over the last couple of days, as you probably know, that there's been an incident here in Australia where Chinese national drivers, delivery food drivers who are potentially going to be part of some kind of labor action, their families are being threatened back in China because the Chinese government doesn't want to see them organizing around politics and labor in a way that may reflect back on Beijing. So these things are driving into our domestic politics. It's affecting labor disputes. It's affecting your universities. It's affecting your media. And I think the question is, do you want the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party to have coercive leverage over Australian society in areas where you really value and probably assume that your freedoms are not at risk? And I just think we are so used to an era in which those things aren't contested. We have not seen our countries be under military coercive leverage in a very long time. I think that would be a real wake-up call, and we ought to prevent that. So,
do you think Australians are naive about the power China wields? I mean, in other interviews, you've talked about warning Australians against cozying up with China. It's not a zero-sum game, is it? It's really, you know, Australia has surely the sophistication to be able to navigate this.
Absolutely. Look, for countries here in the Indo-Pacific, and I travel across and work across the region here in Asia, China is a political, economic, geographic, and cultural reality for countries in the region. And the what I'm proposing is not to make that go away. But maybe I'll talk about my own country rather than making a judgment about Australians. I don't think the United States government has yet to approach the China challenge with the attention, urgency, and resources that it warrants. I think we've been distracted on other issues. I think we've assumed a level of military primacy, assumed a level of technological leadership that, frankly, is not how things are playing out right now. And I think time is running out for the United States and its partners to maintain areas that we want to maintain control and at least an advanced lead in, like technology and military.
The scenario you're describing, where China influences more of the domestic politics of countries like Australia and presumably the region as well, I wonder if America is aware of the fact that we're always calibrating these big, great power relationships. And we have experienced economic coercion, particularly during COVID. Many of the countries in this region, Southeast Asia particularly, have experienced that recently, but also historically. And at the moment, America, you know, issues trade barriers and tariffs at will, removes them at will. Can you understand why these arguments that you're making are viewed with a bit more nuance today?
Of course. And I don't support those policies. I think treating particularly allies in a coercive fashion, levying tariffs against countries like Australia that are not guilty of the kind of economic imbalances and unfair trade practices that do exist in other contexts, does not make strategic sense. And it's undermining U.S. Influence and interest around the world. I think that's widely recognized in Washington. So I agree with you. I don't think that's the permanent state of U.S. foreign policy. And there's a lot of people arguing that, well, we're not going to be able to rewind the clock and go backwards, that we ought to be taking a much different approach to international economics and to our alliances, and that we ought to, particularly in the context of the China challenge, which presents itself in many instances as a challenge of scale, that America will fundamentally need to be working with allies and partners to continue advancing its interests. So I agree it is strategically counterproductive, and doing things that require allies to stick their neck out and take risk is going to be less likely in that context.
You're listening to Global Roaming on Radio National as we talk with former US defence official Dr. Eli Ratner.
And if you're one of these people that has been thinking to yourself, you know, maybe Australia needs to look elsewhere, away from the United States, well, Eli Ratner's got a message for you, and it may involve looking in the mirror. I wonder what you envisage the path back to some kind of more normal American foreign policy and foreign economic policy is. We hear countless Americans say this is an aberration. But then, you know, we're kind of, I guess, talking about, look, do we just have to accept that this is America and it will be America in the future, and Trump is not some blip, that America is going down a different path? Mark Carney certainly thinks so.
Well, I think there may be threads of President Trump's approach to the world that do outlast his presidency. For instance, some of the tariffs, some of the efforts to rebalance economic relationships with partners, which frankly have historically been quite unfair and quite imbalanced as opposed to America's more open market. Also, the desire of the Trump administration to see allies and partners taking on more responsibility within alliance relationships is long overdue. I think that will likely continue. But the excesses we're talking about here, I think, are likely to be corrected. Some of that may happen as soon as the midterm elections, where I think we're likely to see Republicans starting to distance themselves a little bit more from Trump, Democrats maybe taking over one or both houses of Congress, and we're going to have another presidential election before we know it. So that doesn't mean somehow, again, we're going to be able to go back to exactly the way things were before. But I don't think Donald Trump's foreign policy represents the center of American public opinion and foreign policy, and the public opinion polls show that. He's quite unpopular now, and his excessive actions and rhetoric in places like Greenland are very unpopular in the United States. And look at what we're seeing in response to some of his actions. We're seeing millions of people out on the streets of the United States in peaceful protest of what the Trump administration is doing. Are we seeing any mass gatherings in his favor or marches? We're not. So what I'm seeing now is already a process of recalibration. Trump's still president. He's going to be for another 3 years, and that has major consequences, and we ought to not downplay the effects of that. But I also think it would be a misinterpretation to say everything's different, America has changed, American foreign policy is now somehow, again, some moral equivalence to Chinese aggression and assertiveness, and that's a new fact of life. I hope that's not the case, and I think the trend lines are not pointing in that direction.
Do you think some of your allies are now at the point of almost wanting Trump's America to fail?
Well, I think it is interesting watching the responses of allies to this context. And you mentioned...
Because I think your reference of sort of moral equivalence of China and Trump's America, I see and hear that.
Yeah.
People saying, well, maybe we can tolerate some of what China does because Trump's no better.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might dismiss it and say that's an unreasonable comparison.
Yeah.
But it exists. It clearly exists in people's minds.
It does. Look, I guess what I would say here is for folks who are having this reaction of, I really hate what Trump is doing, I'm done with you, I'm done with America, I'm going somewhere else. I mean, maybe take a look in the mirror. What does it mean about your country and your leadership if the minute that there's an American president doing something that you don't like, you want to sever your relationship with the United States? What does that mean about your own understanding of your country's cultural, historical, economic ties with the United States, how deep they are and how important they are? So in some ways, I think not that President Trump's actions haven't been totally unacceptable. I fully agree with that. So I'm not making excuses for them. But I do think the way that countries are responding to President Trump are as much a reflection of them and their beliefs and their commitment. I will just say generally, their commitment to the United States and the U.S. relationship as it is about Donald Trump. So I would recommend, or I wouldn't even say I recommend, I am encouraged by countries, particularly in this region, including the government here and Japan and elsewhere, who are looking a little bit more broadly on the horizon about the broader relationship with the United States and seeing that as something that's deeper and bigger and longer lasting and much more fundamental than just Donald Trump, like you're going to pick up your ball from the playground and go home if you don't like what you're experiencing.
But if some of the other allies who you identify closely with, in Australia's case, for example, Canada and the UK and France and others, are all experiencing the kind of rough end of the pineapple from the United States, it's not just us being coquettish if we think, well, actually, we'd be better to take some distance from Trump's America. It's starting to feel like a broadly held view among allies who we have also have very long historical and cultural links with.
Yeah, and I think it is a fully legitimate response for American allies and partners around the world to be thinking about what does it mean for my future? What does it mean for Australia's future in a world in which the United States is no longer as committed and as reliable, much less becomes a more coercive actor in international politics? You're going to be spending more focus on, you know, how can I protect myself? Do I have the level of autonomy and independence that I need? You're going to be working more with diversifying your partnerships. And we see Australia doing that with Japan and others around the region and the world. I think that's all natural and acceptable. I guess I'm making a different point, which is as you do all that, don't take steps that make it a self-fulfilling prophecy of breaking these relationships in a way when maybe folks are getting a little too wound up in what's the latest outrage on social media and reacting to something that feels very important and very significant. But I think in the long run, not that it's a blip, but that we're going to get through this and we ought to be looking on the future and we ought to look at what's important. And to my earlier point, there's a reason why we have been together and working together and trading together and operating militarily together for a long time. There's a foundation there, and we ought to keep that in mind as we're considering these nearer-term actions to adjust to the reality of Trump's America, but not in the process break a much more fundamental, more important set of relationships.
We've just had Democrat Senator Tim Kaine on the show, and he says that he's confident Australia actually will spend more on defence. Do you think that's inevitable, given the cost of these submarines and this project?
Well, my understanding is we'll know the answer to that in a few months about exactly what kind of increase may occur.
Expectation, though?
Well, I think my expectation is there may be some increase. I'm not convinced we're going to see the level of increase that is necessary to provide for all of the requirements that the Australian military does need to fulfill. And AUKUS has been a hugely intensive thing from a resource perspective. That's important. That ought to continue. That ought to be fully funded and resourced. But I think there are concerns in Washington that the government has cannibalized defense spending in other areas to pay for AUKUS, and that there are really important things like airfield upgrades and infrastructure, missile defense capabilities that maybe won't be receiving the level of resources that they need that are important for defending Australian troops, defending U.S. troops in the event of potential crises or contingency. So my personal view is that, you know, just looking at a percentage of GDP defense spending tends to be counterproductive, but there are important capability areas where we do need to see Australia investing, and I'm not sure we've seen that yet. And what I heard in Canberra is, well, certain folks in the national security apparatus would like to spend more on defense. It's a very fiscally difficult environment. There's a lot of other needs. You know, my reaction to that is, well, welcome to every democracy in the world. And I'm not sure that's going to fly as an excuse as to why the Australian military should not be fulfilling its requirements. So we all have tough issues around social programs and social spending. We all have a lot of demands. And I think there is a question of whether the Australian government is going to be making tough choices and is going to be putting on those at the table and wrestling with this. And to date, I think the answer to that is probably not in a sufficient enough way.
Can you color that in? What circumstances are you talking about? What's the scenario in which this is an issue?
Well, the scenario in which it is an issue is if and when Australian forces, but also U.S. forces, need to be able to operate from Australia. We are in the process of developing a huge number of force posture initiatives throughout Australia, all, I should say, very carefully conducted under the condition of Australia's very important sovereignty policy. But nonetheless, those forces are here in part to defend Australia, but in part also to project power up into the South China Sea or up into the Taiwan Strait or Northeast Asia, such that the United States does not have choke points around its traditional major military bases in South Korea and Japan, which had been the traditional way of getting forces and sustaining forces in the region. Having more points of access and access at further distance from China create much stronger logistics, force flow, and more resilient U.S. military presence in the region. So we are facing a very significant and growing threat. We're facing an ambitious rival. And the investments in deterrence are going to be way cheaper than the investments in dealing with the consequences of crisis and conflict. So we ought to be doing the prevention right now rather than dealing with the disease once it manifests.
Well, Kylie, quite a lot there to unpack. I mean, it will certainly not be lost on listeners, that message to allies, maybe wobbling, maybe wavering. Take a look in the mirror. What does it say about your country that you are nervous because of what Trump's doing?
And when I tried to challenge him on that and say, come on, it's not just us who are nervous. Look at all of our traditional allies who also feel the same way. This is based on something we're seeing before our eyes. He may have understood it, but all the same, the messaging around President Trump's foreign policy was just hold on, this will change, just bear with us, stay strong in the alliance, let's keep building. Beijing is there, nothing has changed in terms of the threat from Beijing, and that's what we should be focused on. And he talked about, I guess, his dream scenario of more points of access, joint command centers, you know, and he talked about he's been addressing military leaders and talking to other kind of strategic thought leaders and the conversations that are going on. But I think also he acknowledged that at a population level, not every Australian voter will necessarily be feeling confident enough to go further down that path with the Americans.
Well, I suppose, interestingly, that scenario, joint commands, joint operating commands, does assume, not necessarily that sovereignty is ceded as such, but it assumes a certain position, that Australia would be on the same side as America. And, you know, I suppose there might be people listening that say, look, we haven't forgotten the history. Actually, Australia has stood side by side with America ever since World War One. Australia has gone into those exploratory conflicts in the Middle East. It hasn't necessarily worked out well. And I do think Australians, rightly or wrongly, have a different view of China. We are in the Asia region. Our geography is different. Big Chinese diaspora here in Australia. Very successful migrant communities from all over Southeast Asia. This changes the shape and even the psychology and the mentality of a nation. So maybe when we do look in the mirror, maybe we see something slightly different to what Americans see when they imagine us looking in the mirror.
If you have any feedback, remember, please keep it coming. Don't forget to write to us. We love your questions. Our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au.
Thanks to our producers, Aston Brown and Shane Anderson. Tomorrow, Jerry and Latika will be here. They're going to look a bit deeper, peel back the layers of the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, the implications of this for the royal family, the British institutions and public. Catch it 11 a.m. or 9 p.m. on Radio National, anytime on ABC Listen. Roam freely and wildly, Kylie. I'll see you next time.
Thanks, Hamish. See you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.